Thank you. My name is Ron St. John, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Lee for asking me to speak. It's an honor, privilege, blah, blah, blah. I just love speaking. I like to hear my own voice on the microphone somehow. That's sort of soothing. And no matter how many times I listen to myself tell my own story, I always find it to be utterly fascinating. I laugh, I cry, and I've heard it before, so hey. I will describe in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And if you look at page 29 of the big book as well, there's a different explanation for our format, which is that we tell in our own way how we found God, and also that even if it's at the risk of bad taste, we fully disclose what actually happened, because that's a way to reach out to newcomers. So this is just a pet peeve of mine, since you're getting the long form of my talk, that when people say share in a general way, it doesn't mean just gloss over everything that you find to be embarrassing and preach for an hour. It means that you tell the truth so that you can reach out to newcomers and they can relate. So this is going to be pretty raw, and just warning you in advance, you know. I was born quite a long time ago, 60 years to be exact, in a little place called Tombstone. Yes, we lived in Tombstone. You now know somebody who's from Tombstone. My dad was in the Army at Fort Huachuca, in Army Intelligence. My dad was a soldier. Always proud to see that on my birth certificate. Father's occupation, soldier, thank you. And, you know, we didn't really stay in Tombstone long enough for me to join up with any posses or anything. We actually moved away when I was only 9 days old, so I probably couldn't find the place now, but I'm still from there. I'm not letting it go. I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan. My dad worked his way through college at University of Michigan, and then he got a job selling computers for IBM. So we sort of moved up the ladder of success. We started out living in a tiny trailer in Chelsea while he was still working his way through college. In case there's a lot of people here that have lived in trailers, yeah, just me, okay. I have a friend from Detroit who was saying, well, Where in Detroit did you live? Where in Detroit did you live? I said, well, after we were in Chelsea, you know, we went to Ann Arbor, we moved to Inkster and Westland and Dearborn. And she's like, Inkster? You lived in Westland? You really lived in Westland? I thought that was just white trash. And I said, well, what the hell do you think I am? All right, but anyways, we worked our way up to really nice suburbs and lived in a big old house with a pool. And so it's, you know, I was the oldest of five kids. My mother was a ballet teacher, so I got what every man here wishes he had, ballet lessons. Also, tap dancing and violin. They thought, well, Ronnie would be good at the violin. That was not a lot of pressure to be all masculine in my house for some reason. By the time I hit second grade, any chance I had of being a badass from Tombstone was gone. I was a skinny little kid who was carrying his violin to school. That was me. I kept to myself most of the time, played by myself in the basement. We had basements with Michigan, and I had brothers and sisters. They just didn't want to play with me either. And I would set up all four sides of the Monopoly board and be all four players. There's lots of people who have done that. Yeah, thank you. So I was a tweaker way before that term was invented. No drugs necessary in my case. I'm still a tweaker. I'm not trying to get over it. That's just how God made me. I didn't need drugs in the first place. I've been sober a long time, and I'm still a big tweaker. I never did take I never took cocaine, I've never tried methamphetamines, and it's too late now. I'm not going to try them. I don't mean to judge the people that did. I'm jealous in a way because I always assumed that those are the people that had really cool friends. The reason I never tried any is because I didn't really have a lot of friends, and like I went through the whole 80s, nobody ever said, "Hey Ron, you want to try some cocaine?" I would have said yes. But, to go back, speaking of drugs, and for me, I feel at liberty to just talk as much about drugs as I feel like talking about it, since I didn't really take all that many of them, and I don't have any question that I'm a real alcoholic. But drugs are not an outside issue. People saying outside drugs is calling it outside issue, is that so that's some sort of private joke? It's silly. Whether or not drugs should be legal, that's an outside issue. Okay? Obamacare, the Confederate flag, anything at all that includes the word Trump, those are outside issues. Immigration, that's an outside issue. I have opinions on all those things, but if I was to share that from the podium, that would be completely inappropriate. It would be rude. But drugs, how much of an outside issue can it be if it ruins your sobriety? If you have to have a new date, it's got to be, you know, the big book talks about sedatives and really. But speaking of drugs, then when I was in school, they had something, they taught us about drugs with something called a film strip. And for young people, I don't really know how to describe a film strip. It was kind of like PowerPoint, but not really. And so, they showed us this film strip, and they warned us that a pusher was going to come to the school, give us some free drugs so that we would get hooked and become addicts and junkies. We waited for that guy. We had nothing but a big drug shortage at my school. It was like, we were pathetic. During this time I also got involved in theater. That turned out to be what I was good at, and so I was, and you know how we are, anything worth doing is worth doing obsessively. I just did one play after another, I read plays in the library, I listened to show tunes on my record player, and if there's young people here, I'll explain record player after the meeting. But so we had a record player. I listened to show tunes. I finally did discover alcohol and also pot when I was 16, and my life got much better because I could finally relax. It changed the world for me completely because now I liked you, and I thought that you liked me. That's a very important difference. It changed my perception, it changed the way I socialized with people. I think that most all of our stories tend to follow a similar pattern to where we all tend to feel isolated and weird and different when we're sober, and we discover alcohol, at least I did, and find out that all the problems I thought I had were just an alcohol deficiency, and once I drink, I'm okay. And then the drinking makes our life better and gets us more socialized, gets us more in contact with people, and we're better salesmen, and we're more likely to get a girlfriend, and blah, blah. But then somehow, it evolves to work exactly the opposite and isolate us into the little one-person world that we become because it's too much hassle to be around with people, and blah, blah, you know, it's easier to drink alone. And my story will kind of follow that pattern, but so let's see, I'm 17, we moved out to Arizona again for no good reason, just because my dad didn't care that he was ruining my life, made me change high schools for senior year. Lots of people that like Arizona, I can't understand why. I spent there a year feeling sorry for myself. It was too hot, the people were goofy, there were a lot of Mormons. No offense to any Mormons who might be here. I don't want to sound like I'm prejudiced against Mormons, but I am. So, and it was, I didn't even know what a Mormon was until I was just surrounded by them, because in Michigan, there weren't any, and in Mesa, Arizona, that's all there is, and that was, Mesa is the place where I was arrested, apprehended, where I was detained by the police force. It was, I had a roach that was about this big. It was ridiculous. And the police found me, and they, you know, they searched me and gave me my rights and everything, and put me in the back of the police car, and I cried because I'm not much of a tough criminal. Turned me over to my school where I got suspended. That was, I mentioned that because that's my whole jacket. If I had a nickel for every time I was arrested, I would have a nickel. In AA, that makes me such a lightweight. I eventually went to law school, and it put me in a different category because I've taken a class on criminal procedure, and we're talking about arrest procedure, and I was the only one that could chime in and say, hey, no, I know about that. Anyways. I left Arizona as soon as I could get out of town. I got a scholarship where I could go to any college I wanted to, and I decided to come out to Hollywood to become a movie star. It made sense at the time, and I started out as a drama student at the University of Southern California. Now, USC was a fun school to go to in the 1970s if you liked to drink. Party, 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 drink, 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 fun all the time, every day. Everyone assumed that I was very wealthy since I was attending USC, which was, it wasn't true, but it was good to have people think that. It helped me to get dates. People thought that I was wealthy because tuition then was extremely expensive. It was $2,950 a year. I had a scholarship for $2,950 a year, so it was not that big of a deal for me. I just had to borrow money to live on for 4 years. And but then I was still kind of broke all the time, you know. It didn't really put much money in my pocket. And something that I figured out right away, because I'm good at math, is if you take alcohol, how much it costs, and you divide by how much money I have, that's a problem. Because there's an awful lot more that I want to drink. So if there were places that had liquor for free, I was there. And there were a lot of places that had liquor for free. Even the university sponsored parties where they gave away free liquor. I don't think they do that anymore, but they didn't care about it at the time. And of course, Fraternity Row. So I would go to every fraternity party that I could possibly go to, one after the other, down a drink quickly, get it refilled, drink it there, and then get another one for the road and drink it on the way to the next party. It was fun times, really. And, you know, you go to those places often enough. Eventually, I did join one of the fraternities. There was a fraternity that had such low standards, they actually accepted me as a member. And I fit in. I can't hardly think of a place. I was just thinking recently the 3.5 years I spent in the fraternity house really kind of formed my personality, and it's just who I am, you know, because it was fraternity life. It revolves around drinking, which is what I'm really good at. There'd be that games, you know, can you drink this much? Can you drink that much? Yeah, I believe I can. You know, let me give that a shot. It was finally I got to step up to the plate, or, you know, if the ping pong ball hits this cup, you have to drink the beer, and if it lands in the cup, you gotta chug the beer. Oh, gosh, yeah. I think I can manage that, actually. It was, not that I was much of a beer fan, because beer, you know, it doesn't taste all that good at first until you've had like 100 of them. And beer, you gotta drink and drink and drink and pee and drink and pee and drink and pee. I would think, why are we drinking beer if there still is gin? Are we out of gin? Is the whole world out of gin? Could we go to the store and buy some? It just seems to get more to the point. But I would drink beer if it were, and I had this happen recently. A guy that does IT at my office, you know, he has to be nice to me. He's an outside sales guy. And he asked me, he says, do you prefer hard spirits or beer? And I said, well, it's very interesting you should ask that question, because I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober for 26 years. And he says, yeah, but when you did drink, did you prefer hard liquor or beer? I said, oh, that's a dumb question. Hard liquor, of course, I can't stand beer. He says, what kind of beer did you drink when you drank beer? I said, well, at first I drank anything I could get a hold of, Charlie Black Label or Pabst, crap like that. And then, of course, when I moved out west, I had to drink Coors, because that was just, we were obliged back then. We could only get Coors in the west, so I drank a lot of Coors just because we could. It wasn't all that great as people in the East Coast thought it was, but it was all right. And then I would switch to Miller High Life, the champagne and bottled beers, because it fit my personality. I didn't want to drink Budweiser and just be like everybody else. And then if we got keg beer, I figured out it would only cost $2 extra to get Michelob, and that made a difference, and that was worth it. Plus, if I was drinking the beer that I paid for myself, you only taste the first beer. So I would drink one bottle of Michelob and a case of Lucky Lager, because then it just made sense. And of course, later I would drink, when I was more of a yuppie, I would drink Löwenbräu or Heineken, and then if you have Mexican food, you have to have Corona. And I thought to myself, you know, considering I haven't even had a taste of beer for over 26 years, and that I never liked it in the first place, I sure remember it an awful lot. About all the beers. I wouldn't be able to explain to you how much tacos I ate. But, you know, I'm an alcoholic, what can I say? Anyways, I joined the fraternity. I dropped out of the drama department. Drama people were getting on my nerves. I wanted to be a little more normal. I was way tired of people thinking I was gay. It's okay to be gay. I know there's no gay people in Central Valley. This is more of an issue down in L.A., but it's okay to be gay, but nobody ever seems to mean it as a compliment. I was a skinny, long-haired drama student who knew a lot of show tunes. That didn't mean that I wanted to have sex with other men. It doesn't work that way. I don't want to even have to explain it. I had a different sexual problem, very serious one, which I will share with you since we're all so close. The problem was that I wanted sex way more often than I was ever gonna get it. And I don't mean I wanted it a little bit and thought it might be a nice idea. I mean I was desperate, I was angry, my skin hurt, my hair hurt, I needed to touch some girl parts, or somebody was gonna pay. And I was very shy. I was afraid of girls, I was afraid of rejection, and then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because what women are attracted to is self-confidence. They just can't help themselves. That whole cliche about being attracted to the bad guy, they're not attracted to just any bad guy. They want the bad guy who's in charge of all the other bad guys, okay? So if you just stand in the corner with the live bands going on and such and say, oh, you're probably kind of tired, you don't really want to dance with me, you know? It doesn't get you anywhere. It's just, now, alcohol was a complete solution to my problem, because once you drink, then you lose your inhibitions. I did anyways. All the girls in the room turn into supermodels. I don't know how that works, but so you're much more likely to succeed. And my chances of success increased from 0% to about 5%. That's a very important difference. That's like once a month if you keep after it enough. And the rest of the time, once you drink enough, who cares? Now you don't need it anymore anyways, what's the point? So I would repeat that over and over again. I would, you know, the drinking as a substitute for getting laid, It's just so much easier. I mean, no offense to the ladies here, but you're kind of a lot of trouble. The relationship that you have with a bottle of Southern Comfort is just so simple. You buy it, you pour it, you drink it. You don't have to wait for the bottle to be in the mood before you drink it. You don't have to be nice to its friends. It doesn't care about Valentine's Day. It doesn't care if you were drinking something else the night before. It's just that easy. And while I'm losing the affection of every woman in the room, let me mention one other thing. I have this long-standing resentment against all the beautiful, beautiful women that come up to microphones like these and will say, oh, I would drink and then I would black out and I just didn't know who I was going to wake up with. Where were you? That's what I was always hoping for. I would drink, I would black out, and I would wake up by myself. On the floor in my bathroom, which is a convenient place. It's nice and safe. If you're already lying on the floor, then you won't fall down. Just a tip in case any of you newcomers go out and drink again. Okay, so what kind of put a buzzkill onto those happy days back then was that I did figure out that I was an alcoholic. And I started to worry that other people might find out that I'm an alcoholic, which would be a problem because then they would want me to stop drinking. They would want me to go to that A&A thing, which I'd seen on the movies, and I knew was a really bad idea for me because in AA you don't take the first drink because the first drink leads to more drinks, etc., etc. But if you don't take the first drink, that means not drinking at all, which is not a practical solution for me because I have a special kind of alcoholism, the kind where I still have to drink. And then trying to explain that to people, you know it sounds wrong before it even comes out of your mouth, even though it's the God's truth. And so then it becomes a secret. That's a secret, this is a secret, everything's a secret. I would hide my drinking from guys who drank all day. It didn't matter. You know how sometimes we lie about stuff just to stay in practice? I would put vodka in a can of grape soda so it looked like I was drinking grape soda. Not that anybody cared, but just in case they did, I was just practicing how I could hide the drinking. And I did that, I basically did that for the next 12 years until I ended up getting sober. I went about keeping my drinking secret and controlled. I finished college, I got married. I went to law school, I had kids, I had 4 kids. I got a job, passed the bar, and lived in a big house in San Gabriel eventually. Doesn't sound like a low bottom. It sounds like a success story. Didn't feel like a success story to me. I felt like a fraud and a failure. I felt like I was just keeping all these damn secrets. I just had this miserable life. It was, I had a beautiful life. I just didn't appreciate it. Let's put it differently. I was surrounded by these kids. I love kids. I'm the right person to have lots of kids. I especially love my kids. But they just adored me, and I took them for granted, and it didn't seem like a big deal. And I should have been more appreciative of it at the time. I had married this girl who was half Italian. And if you're half Italian, the Italian half kills off the other half, and you're just Italian. So I was related to in-laws, Italian in-laws. There were probably about 100 or 1,000 or maybe 10,000 of them. I don't know. And we would have, like, parties every weekend, which that's how I ended up doing no drugs in the 80s, because that just inhales your whole life, because it's always somebody's birthday, somebody's anniversary, somebody's graduation or baptism or confirmation. It's something. And it's always the same party, same food, the same sausage sandwiches, the same cannolis, the same cake. It just has different writing on the sheet cake, you know. It's just, and everybody's all the little, the Italian word for pretty babies was pupubedus. All the little poo-poo-baitos running around. I did my share in adding more poo-poo-baitos to the group. I kept trying to learn all these crazy words they would come up with. I think some of them they just made up. I get some of them are intuitive, like Panza or Kulu. If you're getting a big Panza and you sit around on your Kulu, that makes sense. And there was just one kind of great grandma who was the matriarch of the group and had the status of a goddess. Essentially, you had to sort of pay tribute to her, like put salt at her feet or something like that. And so she would ask me questions like, how come you got Funja? I looked that up in every kind of Italian American dictionary I could find. What do you mean, how come I got a Funja? You mean funky? Like I got a mushroom on my face? Because, yeah, why you got a Funja? Finally, I eventually did see an Italian movie years later where in the same context, same tone of voice, they asked a guy, che faccia? And it was translated as, why the long face? Oh, now I get it. And Funja is just a mispronunciation of faccia. She was just saying, what's wrong with your face? What's wrong with my face is they weren't serving any alcohol at those parties. I was like, where's the wine? Don't you guys watch TV? I thought Italian people were supposed to like wine. There's no wine. So I put myself in charge of the bar for these parties. And I came up with a drink. They were non-drinkers. And I came up with a drink they would like. I would fill a big glass with ice. I would put in a little bit of Kahlua and a lot of milk. And they thought that was genius. It was delicious. And for me, I would do the same thing with a glass of ice, except I would fill it with vodka. And then I would add a little bit of milk and Kahlua on the top to give it some color and make it look like their drink. And then I would just drink that so it could get me to where I needed to be. And if it got down to about halfway, I would add more vodka and just top it off. Because that way, if they asked me how many drinks I had, I could just say one. Because it was the same drink, I just kept topping it off. Okay? Okay. Not that anybody ever asked, but just in case, you know. Where was I? So I became this miserable henpecked husband during that time. Sorry to have to say that, but it's the reality of what happened. My poor wife, she started out so friendly and cheerful. Yeah, I guess it's more guys that have gone through this than I have. It's just, she was just angry all the time, mostly at me, and I'm sure there was a reason for it, but geez. I'm just all feeling sorry for myself, and she's just trying to reach out to me, like, do you love me? You know, are you involved in this relationship? Do something. That she never said that, but and what she did say just sounded like, nag, 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 nag. Why do you always blah, blah, blah? How come you never blah, blah, blah? When are you going to fix the blah, blah, blah? I called her Big Chief, we need a new. Because it was, we need a new car, we need a new couch, we need a new kitchen, we need a new house. And I'm thinking, why can't I just die? I would like to die. Maybe I could get a disease that doesn't hurt too much and isn't my fault. Maybe I could go to jail. I could end up in jail. I don't know why I would go to jail, but I would like to be in jail. When people complain about jail, jail would be a vacation for me. I would go to jail. And then my poor wife would ask me a question like, what are you thinking about? What I should have said was, I'm thinking about going to jail or killing myself because you drive me crazy. That's what I should have said. Just be honest. But I never did. I would say something like, oh, nothing, I'm just tired. So you can see how much fun it was to be married to me. I just lived in a little dream world of self-pity. Go to work. Wasn't all good at that. Didn't make nearly as much money as people thought. It's kind of depressing, too stressful. I was stuck in this damn job. I would, if I got a few minutes to myself, I would go to a topless bar just so I could drink gin and watch pretty girls take off their clothes. Because everybody needs a hobby. I seem to be the only person in all of AA who's ever been to a topless bar, because nobody else ever mentions them. I'm the only one. Which is fine. I had an experience when I was sober that I was thinking back on this place called the Wild Goose out by the airport in LA. It wasn't necessarily my favorite place, but it was among my top 5 or 10 favorite places. And the Wild Goose, they had a full bar, which is a good touch, multiple big screen TVs with every sporting event that you could ever dream of. This is in the days when people didn't have big screen TVs. And big screen TVs, full bar, multiple stages, so there's more than one grill at a time entertaining, and a buffet. So it was like, why ever leave? And I was, in sobriety, I was remembering back on that, and I was talking to this buddy at the yard. We go to Clancy's house and play ball on Saturday sometimes, and we're sitting around waiting to play ball, just us tough guys out there ready to play some softball. And I told him about the Wild Goose. And he just looked at me. You don't expect to be judged at the yard, right? He looked at me and he said, "You ate the food at the Wild Goose? That's disgusting." Anyways, I would eat that food again now. I don't care. So during those times, I was also getting really sick because you can lie to the world about your drinking. You can keep it secret from your friends and your family if you're good enough at it, but you can't lie to your own body. Your body keeps score of how much you've been drinking. I had an ulcer. I had gout. Who gets gout? I got gout. I had insomnia and hives, all that. I was going to the doctor's office and I was going to the dentist. And so I finally, she kind of sent me like, maybe this was stress, and so I'm doing therapy. I was going through my midlife crisis then. I started my midlife crisis. I had a good start out when I was 28. I tried to keep it up continuously in the whole, what's it been now, 32 years since. I've been in a midlife crisis more than half my life. If I let go of it now, then I'm just old. So it's like, you know. But then I did therapy and I did exercise and self-help books, and those are all good things, but it's not really a cure for alcoholism. And then what did get me into the 12-step program eventually, this was, you know, kind of how I spent the 80s, and people were into that sort of self-improvement type stuff in the 80s and the exercise, and I ate oat bran, all that kind of stuff if you were there. I've always kind of followed along with whatever's going on at the time. And you get all the way to the spring of 1990. My wife at the time, my first wife, I'm not so married to her, she got honest about something she'd been doing, which took me totally by surprise, and was a form of bulimia. She told me that she had been, she thought she'd had a heart attack, and that she was worried it was because she was abusing laxatives. So she's telling me, "I just have to tell you something, I've been taking laxatives." And I'm like, "Why? Who would take laxatives? That doesn't even sound fun. That's ridiculous." "Oh, I take them, how often?" "Oh, every day." "Every day? Oh, that sounds like a punishment. I wouldn't do that on a dare." "Like, how many do you take?" "Like, two, that's the recommended dose, that's nothing." "No, two bottles." "Oh, okay, that's a lot." So I had to get her into a rehab so I could fix her and make my life better, essentially. It was nice to know the real problem that I'd had all these years, her. Once we fix her, then things will be great. So let's get her into a rehab. I was just driving around town with her toothbrush and an insurance form. "This place is nice, let's stay here, I'll get your stuff." It'll be, you know, she wasn't that anxious about it, really. And you know how before you go into a rehab, you've got lots of little details to take care of? One of the details for us was our oldest son, my son David, had this nervous tic where it was like his face was bleeding from this compulsive tic that he had. And we took him to doctor and doctor and doctor, and we finally had to take him to the City of Hope to talk to a research scientist, a research doctor there. And then we had this appointment just one day before she went into the rehab for bulimia. And he just took the history and looked at some video of what he was doing. Okay, he says it's a form of Tourette syndrome. And it's a genetic problem, but you can't blame each other because it has to come from both sides of the family. Okay, that's interesting. He says the typical scenario is that the father's an alcoholic and the mother has an eating disorder. I'm like, wow, you're not going to believe where we're going tomorrow. And it didn't surprise him at all. So here's my theory. Alcoholics, drug addicts, people with eating disorders, we're in the minority, but we find each other and we mate. And through selective breeding, we are creating superior strains of alcoholism for the future. I've done my part in that experiment. Anyways, we get her into the rehab. Her rehab was the most intense 3 weeks of my life. I couldn't get enough of that place. I loved rehab. Rehab, what's not to like about rehab? You sit around in your PJs all day talking about yourself. You don't have a care in the world. Somebody else is doing your cooking. I don't get people complaining about rehab. I went there as much as I could, and I did the art projects, and they were telling me, oh, you better come to our codependency class on Tuesday. And I'm like, codependency? Gosh, what's that? Well, codependency, listen. This is a new disease, and you might not have heard of it because we only made it up a couple months ago. But not only do you have it, but you are in denial about the fact that you have it. I'm like, wow. So I didn't stay in denial for very long. I jumped right on the codependency bandwagon. I basically bought and read any book at all that had the word codependent in the title. I just inhaled all that information. I even went around calling myself a people pleaser. I did that for several years into sobriety until one day I looked around my life and I realized I couldn't point to one single person who really was pleased. This is just my opinion. I think if you're a people pleaser, keep up the good work. But if you can't point to several people who really are pleased, you might as well stop accusing yourself of that. So I'm trying to help her get better, and I'm reading. I read the big book. That was part of what they gave her, the big book. So the big book just cures everything, according to these hospitals. And so they gave her the big book, and so I read it for her because I'm a good reader. And I was actually drinking while I read the big book. In case there's lots of other people who have done that, that's okay, somebody else did. I had a straight Kahlua that I was drinking out of one of my kids' sippy cups. Partly because I took it dirty out of the dishwasher, drank the Kahlua, rinsed it out, and put it back in the same place in the dishwasher, just in case anybody was keeping track to see whether or not I was drinking, I would be covering my tracks, right? Okay. If you're gonna lie, attention to detail is very important. But I'm reading the big book while I'm sipping away the Kahlua and thinking, wow, I can relate to this. Oh, yeah, that's me. That's me. I thought I was gonna find my social security number in that book. They seem to know so much about me. So I joined Adult Children Anonymous. Adult Children's Anonymous is a good organization. You sit and tell all your secrets and people like you anyways. You work the steps and you can still drink. And so that kind of worked for me for a while, but I kind of figured out from my friends in ACA that if you're gonna stop drinking, and I did stop drinking, I figured I better nip this alcoholism thing in the bud by not drinking. And I just white-knuckled it myself because I don't like to ask people for help. But then I would make exceptions. Well, the rules doesn't apply because, you know, blah, blah. Socrates is a man. All men are mortal. A plus B equals C. Therefore, I should have a drink. That's the end of every logical progression in my mind. So I'm going to these meetings, but they say, well, you keep track of the number of days that you're sober, and then you gain prestige within the group based on how long it's been since your last drink. So I counted back to the last time I'd had some margaritas on July 13th, 1990, and then that became my date, and I started counting the days and telling people as if they really cared how many days it had been since I was sober. But then that's when my life became completely unbearable, because now no matter how badly I needed a drink and how sure I was the rule shouldn't apply, I couldn't start over again on my days because then I would have to tell people, and I just didn't want to do that, and I just didn't feel like I was going to be able to lie about that to those people. And so I just, whether I could stand it or not, I kept staying sober, and it got so bad I started coming to AA meetings. And I hated to. I felt like I should apologize for being here. But I came anyways. And people were still nice to me. I was miserable, and I got to a point where I went to a small participation meeting figuring, I need to feel better today. I'm going to burn this meeting. I'm going to tell them the truth once and for all and then never go back. Because I don't know why, but I am. And I raised my hand. I'm wrong. I'm an ungrateful alcoholic. I've been sober for 93 days. And don't clap. Enough with the clapping. I'm sick of the clapping. It's I'm not really impressed with the steps. And I'm very embarrassed to be here. I don't even remember why I'm trying to stay sober. And I haven't met one single person in AA that I like. So thank you for letting me share. People came up after the meeting and they hugged me. And they said, oh, you're so funny. You keep coming back. We love it when you come as a runner. You should get a commitment here. I'm like, what do you got to do to get yourself kicked out of this place, really? Well, they told me to keep coming back, so I would keep coming back and get a commitment. You know, I had the commitment and I got through. I just got through a lot of stuff. I got to the point where I had a year sober almost, and so I decided to go through that divorce that I'd been saving up for, and divorcing a Sicilian girl is not as much fun as you would think. I wanted a nice friendly divorce, but that didn't happen. She's still angry, and it was a long time ago. This happened like 25 years ago, and so I kind of have a lost it all in sobriety story, because the stories that you hear, like the low bottom kind of stories where people lose their family and lose the house and they have the financial catastrophes and the kids don't want to speak to them, and that all never happened to me while I drank, and it all happened after I got sober. But at the same time, I was feeling better. My health was getting better. I had friends that I could talk to. I had people that I could share things with. And that's a very important difference. And so I just kind of stuck in there, hung in there. I was remembering a time, this is early on in my sobriety, I still didn't really have a sponsor or anything, just going to meetings and doing my commitments and such. But it just happened that I was coming back from court in Pomona, and it was right around the time the topless bar was opened, so I thought I might just stop by just to sit and meditate and just enjoy the show. And if you've been to these places, the dancers, in between sets, they will circulate among us polite gentlemen to sell more drinks, essentially. And for the sake of decency, they will wear like a little bikini top and a G-string. And so then, you know, it adds to the whole ambiance. But then, I was next to a guy who had ordered a pitcher of beer. And I've already told you that beer wasn't my favorite thing, but there's a certain aesthetic to beer. Like if you have it in a pitcher and you're pouring it into a glass and you're doing it just right, like the bubbles will circle in a little oval, you know what I'm talking about? And the foam will rise up very gently, and it has a certain smell and it has a certain sound. So this guy on the table next to me, he's just getting to the good part where he's gonna pour the beer from the pitcher into the glass. Now what happens? One of the dancers walked right in front of me. Her bare bottom was like this close to my face. Ordinarily, I would pay extra for that, by the way. But at this particular time, what I heard my brain say was, get your fat ass out the way. I'm trying to watch this guy pour a beer. And then I thought, what have I become? I didn't say it out loud, but how could I even think such a thing? And then I'm like, I really am an alcoholic. Like, oh God, why me? Why me? You know, like having any kind of disease. I got out of that place without drinking. I kind of told that story enough to where I used to be sponsored by a guy named Frank Jones. I was sponsored by him for 13 years, and he died almost exactly 2 years ago now. And Frank, he was a psychotic murderer. He was a sniper in Vietnam. He had a voice that sounded just like Clint Eastwood. And so you did whatever he said. And he told me early on in sponsoring me, he's like, Ron, if you ever go to another topless bar, I will hunt you down and shoot you. So as soon as he died, we hadn't even had his memorial yet. As soon as he died, my wife, my current wife, is in the AA. She's another circuit speaker who's going to be speaking here pretty soon. My wife right away says to me, do you remember when Frank told you that if you went to a topless bar, he would shoot you? He says, now that he's dead, if you go to a topless bar, I will shoot you in honor of his memory. Like, okay, fine. So it's been an awful long time since I've been to any of those places, and some of them are still in business, but whatever. I stayed sober. I managed to get through all this crap by going to meetings and learning the steps, and when I eventually did get a sponsor, life did get quite a bit easier when I got commitments, especially. I think commitments, I got commitments pretty early on. Commitments are a very, very important part of getting sober in AA. My wife and I once went all the way to Switzerland to speak on working the steps and such. And something that we emphasized was, it was like the difference between working the steps and going to meetings. To me, there's not really that much of a difference. To me, to work the steps, you have to go to the meetings. It's not a do-it-yourself program. It's not something that you can read out of a book and just get out of the book. If you look at the steps, the first word in the first step is we. The we, us, our occurs all throughout the steps, and you never see the word I, and you never see the word you. It's something that we do together as a group. That's just to pause for a little preaching. So I was involved in the group, and I knew I was accountable. If I was at a topless bar, I knew I wasn't going to drink, because I didn't want to have to explain that at the group where I was like the secretary. You know, and that accountability and that group dynamic, you know, the peer pressure, the positive reinforcement, yay for Ron, he got sober, give him a cake, that kind of thing. And just the modeling that you get, those are the most effective forms of behavioral modification that exist. And you only get that if you come to the meeting. You don't get that by spending a weekend doing the steps and then doing something else nice in the world, like going to church or donating blood or something. You have to keep coming back to the meetings. That's why we have to go to the meetings basically the rest of our life, and to keep being of service to others so that we can remember our disease and we can reinforce the idea that we're not going to drink anymore. But anyways, to go back to my story, then I went through all those difficult things, staying sober, going to meetings, got the sponsor. I met this super pretty girl, totally out of my league. She was, I just followed her around for a while, and after about 5 years, we ended up getting married. We've now been married for 21 years, and I'm a lucky guy. We've been through a lot of difficult things in sobriety. For one thing, you know, I had the 4 kids and paying all my money in child support. She had 3 kids paying all her money in child support. Well, we were obviously the perfect pair. And, you know, we were kind of broke and such, but then and plus, being a step-parent is its own special challenge. Your stepchildren don't really love you at first, and except the middle-aged one sort of did. He was such a friendly guy, big football player, and we would sit and play cards and everything. And then the toughest thing we dealt with in sobriety was in 2001, April the 19th, when we lost him. He went away on spring break his senior year of high school, and he didn't come back. He was in a car crash. He was the only fatality. It wasn't his fault. It's just one of those things that happened. Worst thing that can possibly happen. It's indescribable grief. But we both went through it, and we both did it without any drugs or medication and without drinking. And we kept going to our meetings, and we kept checking in with our sponsor. It was, that was in 2001. It was just a couple of years after that I ended up being diagnosed with throat cancer. which is one of the things that we're vulnerable to with the history of heavy drinking, even if we don't smoke, unfortunately. It's a bad day when you get diagnosed with malignant tumors. It's depressing. But I did what I did to handle any other problems that have come up. Suit up, show up, do the next indicated thing, and I kept checking in with my sponsor. That was that time I was being sponsored by Frank Jones then, too. I'd call him, Frank, yeah, we got the test results back, and those tumors are malignant. There's a long pause, and he's like, well, have you gotten any insurance? I'm like, yeah, I think you should have had me as a beneficiary. I found out the difference between, I found the difference between alcoholism and cancer, because I've survived both. With cancer, you get a lot of support from the public, from general, people you barely know will start having peer groups for you. It's embarrassing. Alcoholism, not so much. Like, you notice with cancer, they'll have walkathons and little yellow bands. It can be no walkathons for us alcoholics. It's not. And alcoholism kills you just as dead as cancer. How come nobody cares? Only we're the only ones who care, and even we don't care. Our attitude to treatment of it is very different, too. Because with cancer, the treatment consists of torture. The treatment consists of poison. They're going to poison the cancer and almost kill you in the process, or maybe start chopping off body parts. I've had 4 different times where I've signed consent forms of where they're going to chop off a little piece of my tongue or some other part of my body. Nobody's going to chop off your tongue here in AA. The cure for alcoholism, the life-saving cure for alcoholism, no chemo, no radiation, you have to read this book. You got to get a sponsor and go to meetings. And then here is most of us when we hear that news. Oh, no. My case isn't that bad, you know. You're like a cancer patient saying, I'm only stage 3. If I get to stage 4, maybe, but I've seen other people that are worse, so goodbye. That's what we do. I got through the cancer, got through all this kind of stuff, and I'm cancer-free now. I was thinking about it because they keep finding stuff to scare me about, and then it turns out to be nothing. That just keeps happening over and over again, and I'm getting sick of it, really. They saw something in my jaw recently. Oh no, I can't do dental work. Oh no, that's like right ground zero where they radiated me. And I thought, oh, my jaw is dying. And I'm planning the music for my memorial and such, but it turned out that my jaw wasn't dying. The area was just extra thickening of the bone tissue because my jaw was doing such a good job of healing. It wasn't death, it was life. It was healing. There's a metaphor lurking in there somewhere. I don't know what to do with it, but a lot of times the pain that we go through will be us healing. As we yawn our way through meetings and suffer and what's wrong with us, especially as we detox the first year, it's hard to recognize it as it's happening to you, but really, it's healing. You're healing. It doesn't feel good while it's happening, but it'll look better as you look back on it. That's why you need to stay really close to the meetings for your first year, every day, ideally, in my opinion. Life has gone reasonably well since then. I try to stay in the solution. I built my practice back up, and finances are still not the best, but we're doing much better, looking forward to retirement and such. We're empty nesters, the kids are all grown and gone. We just dote over our grandchildren now. It's a good life. My wife and I have been together a long time. We do these things together. It's a good way to live. So, the lesson being, if you stay sober for 26 years, there's no guarantee that you're going to have a great job and live near the beach and be married to a smoke and dine piece. Even though that's what happened to me. But you have a reasonable chance of sleeping through the night and waking up in the morning with a clear head and a clear conscience, and whatever it is you have to deal with, it's always the same solution. You suit up, you show up, you do the next indicated thing. The past is something you can't change at all, so you have to let it go. The future belongs to God. We focus on one day at a time, and it's a good way to live that way. And just trust that things are going to come together. So if you want to live that way too, you can. You keep coming back to these meetings. We'll be here. You do the stuff we do, your life gets better. Thanks for letting me show.
Let's give Ron another round of applause. Forgot my paper over there. Oopsie.
Thanks.
All right. I want to welcome our newcomers, Mike, Ashley, and Stephanie.